catfish leaned farther forward, a cartoon leer spreading across its noseless face. The teeth inside that flabby grin looked longer and sharper now. Ralph saw drops of colorless fluid beading the ends of the whiskers and thought, poison. Spend the rest of your life in a wheelchair. Man, I'm so scared. Scared to fucking death. Lois screaming far away. Hurry, Ralph! You have to hurry! A little boy was screaming from somewhere a lot closer. Screaming and waving his right hand. Waving the fish clinging to the fingers buried inside the gullet of a pregnant monster that would not let go. The catfish leaned closer yet. The dress it wore rustled. Ralph could smell his mother's perfume, St. Helena, mixed obscenely with a fishy, garbagey aroma of bottom feeder.
I intend a deep nose errand to end in success, Ralph. I intend that the boy your friends told you about should die in his mother's arms, and I want to see it happen. I've worked very hard here in Derry, and I don't feel that's too much to ask, but it means I have to finish with you right now.
Ralph took a step deeper into the thing's garbagey stink, and now he began to see a shape behind the shape of Mother, behind the shape of the queenfish. He began to see a bright man, a red man with cold eyes and a merciless mouth. This man resembled the Christ he had seen only moments ago, but not the one which had really hung in his mother's kitchen corner. An expression of surprise came into the lidless black eyes of the queenfish, and into the cold eyes of the red man beneath.
What do you think you're doing? Get away from me! Do you want to spend the rest of your life in a wheelchair?
I can think of worse things, pal. My days of playing first base are pretty definitely over.
The voice rose, becoming the voice of his mother when she was angry.
Pay attention to me, boy! Pay attention and mind me!
For a moment, the old commands, given in a voice so eerily like his mother's, made him hesitate. Then he came on again. The queenfish shrank back in the rocker, its tail flipping up and down below the hem of the old house dress.
Just what do you think you're doing?
I don't know. Maybe I just want to give your whiskers a tug. See for myself if they're real.
And exerting all of his willpower to keep from shrieking and fleeing, he reached out with his right hand. Lois's earring felt like a small, warm pebble closed within his fist. Lois herself seemed very close, and Ralph decided that wasn't surprising, considering how much of her aura he'd taken on. Perhaps she was even a part of him now. The feeling of her presence was deeply comforting.
No, you don't dare. You'll be paralyzed.
Catfish aren't poisonous. That was the story of a 10-year-old boy who might have been even more scared than I was.
Ralph reached for the whiskers with a hand concealing the metal thorn, and the massive, scaly head flinched away, as some part of him had known it would. It began to ripple and change, and its fearful red aura began to seep through. If sickness and pain had a color, Ralph thought, that would be it. And before the change could go any further, before that man he could now see, tall and coldly handsome, with his blonde hair and glaring red eyes, could step through the shimmer of the illusion it had cast, Ralph drove the sharp point of the earring into one black and bulging fisheye. It made a terrible buzzing sound, like a cicada, Ralph thought, and tried to draw back. Its rapidly flipping tail produced a sound like a fan with a piece of paper caught in the blades. It slid down in the rocker, which was now changing into something that looked like a throne carved from dull orange rock. And then the tail was gone, the queenfish was gone, and it was the Crimson King sitting there, his handsome face twisted into a snarl of pain and amazement. One of his eyes glared as red as the eye of a lynx in firelight. The other was filled with a fierce, splintered glow of diamonds. Ralph reached into the blanket of eggs with his left hand, ripped it away, and saw nothing but blackness on the other side of the abortion, the other side of the death bag, the way out.
You were warned, you short-time son of a bitch. You think you can pull my whiskers? Well, let's see, shall we? Let's just see.
The Crimson King leaned forward again on its throne, its mouth yawning, its remaining eye blazing with red light. Ralph fought the urge to yank his now empty right hand away. Instead, he pistoned it forward toward the mouth of the Crimson King, which yawned wide to engulf it, as that long-ago catfish had done that day in the Barrens. Things, not flesh, first squirmed and jostled against his hand, then began to bite like horseflies. At the same time, Ralph felt real teeth, no, fangs, sink into his arm. In a moment, two at the most, the Crimson King would bite through his wrist and swallow his hand whole. Ralph closed his eyes and was at once able to find that pattern of thought and concentration which allowed movement between the levels. His pain and his fear were no bar to that. Only this time his purpose was not to move, but to trigger. Clotho and Lachesis had planted a booby trap inside his arm, and the time had come to set it off. Ralph felt that sensation of blink inside his head. The scar on his arm immediately went white-hot and critical. That heat didn't burn Ralph, but flew out from him in an expanding ripple of energy. He was aware of a titanic green flash, so bright that for one moment it was as if the Emerald City of Oz had exploded all around him. Something or someone was screaming. That high, jagged sound would have driven him mad if it had gone on for long, but it didn't. It was followed by a vast, hollow bang that made Ralph think of the time he had lit an M-80 firecracker and tossed it into a steel culvert. A sudden rush of force blew past him, in a fan of wind and fading green light. He caught a strange, skewed glimpse of the Crimson King, no longer handsome and no longer young, but ancient and twisted, and less human than the strangest creature to ever flop or hop its way along the short-time level of existence. Then something above them opened, revealing darkness shot through with conflicting swirls and rays of color. The wind seemed to blow the Crimson King up toward it, like a leaf in a chimney flue. The colors began to brighten, and Ralph turned his face away, raising one hand to shield his eyes. He understood that a conduit had opened between the level where he was and the unimaginable level stacked above it. He also understood that if he looked for long into that brightening glow, those deadlights, swirling colors, then death would not be the worst thing that could happen to him, but the best. He did not just squeeze his eyes shut, he squeezed his mind shut. A moment later, everything was gone. The creature which had identified itself to Ed as the Crimson King, the kitchen in the old house on Richmond Street, his mother's rocking chair. Ralph was kneeling on thin air, about 6 feet to the right of the Cherokee's nose, his hands upraised as an off-beaten child might raise his hands before the approach of a cruel parent. And when he looked between his knees, he saw the Civic Center and the adjacent parking lot directly below him. At first he thought his eyes were being fooled by an optical illusion, because the arc sodiums in the parking lot seemed to be spreading apart. They almost looked like a crowd of very tall, very skinny people, which is starting to break up because the excitement, whatever it was, is over. And the lot itself seemed to be, well, expanding. Not expanding, but getting closer, Ralph thought coldly. He's going down. He started his kamikaze run. For a moment, Ralph was frozen in place, enchanted by the simple wonder of his position. He'd become a mythical in-between creature, clearly no god. No god could be as tired and terrified as he was right now, but clearly no such earthbound creature as a man, either. This was what it was really like to fly, to see the earth from above, with no border around it. This... Ralph! Her scream was like a shotgun fired beside his ear. Ralph flinched from it, and the moment his gaze left the hypnotic sight of the ground swelling up toward him, he was able to move. He rose to his feet and walked back to the plane. He did this as easily and normally as a man walking down a hallway in his own home. No wind buffeted his face or blew his hair back from his brow, and when his left shoulder passed through the Cherokee's propeller, the whirling blade harmed him no more than it would have harmed smoke. For a moment he saw Ed's pallid, handsome face, the face of the highwayman who'd come riding up to the old inn door in the poem which had always made Carolyn cry, and his previous feeling of mingled pity and regret was replaced by anger. It was difficult to become really infuriated with Ed. He was, after all, just another chess piece being moved across the board, and yet the building he had aimed his airplane at was full of real people, innocent people. Ralph saw something balky, childish, and willful about the dopey expression of disassociation on Ed's face. And as he passed through the thin skin of the cockpit wall, Ralph thought, I think that on some level, Ed, you knew the devil had come in. I think you might even have been able to put him out again. Didn't Mr. C and Mr. L say there's always a choice? If there is, you have to own a piece of this, goddamn you. For a moment, Ralph's head poked through the ceiling, as it had done before, and he knelt again. Now the Civic Center filled the entire windshield of the plane, and he understood that it was too late to stop Ed from doing something. He had pulled the doorbell free of the tape. He was holding it in his hand. Ralph reached into his pocket and gripped the remaining earring, once again holding it between his fingers with the prong sticking out. He curled his other hand into a tube around the wires running between the cardboard carton and the doorbell. Then he closed his eyes and concentrated, creating that flexing sensation in the middle of his head again. There was a sudden, hollow, fluttery sensation in his stomach, and he had time to think, "Whoa, this is the express elevator." Then he was down on the short-time level, where there were no gods or devils, no bald doctors with magic scissors and scalpels, no auras. Down where passing through walls and walking away from plane crashes was an impossibility. Down on a short-time level where he could be seen. And Ed, Ralph realized, was doing just that. Ralph? It was the drugged voice of a man just waking from his life's soundest sleep. Ralph Roberts? What are you doing here? Oh, I was in the neighborhood and I thought I'd drop in, Ralph said. Drag up a rock, so to speak. And with that, he closed his curled hand into a fist and tore the wires out of the box. No! Ed shrieked. Oh, no, don't! You'll spoil everything! Yes, indeed, Ralph thought, then reached over Ed's lap to grab the Cherokee's control wheel. The Civic Center was now no more than 1,200 feet below them, perhaps less. Ralph still didn't know for sure what was in the box strapped to the co-pilot's chair. But he had an idea it was probably the plastique stuff the terrorists always used in the martial arts movies starring Chuck Norris and Steven Seagal. It was supposed to be fairly stable, not like the nitro in Clouseau's Wages of Fear, certainly. But this was hardly the time to put his trust in the gospel of movie land. And even a stable explosive might go off without a detonator when dropped from a height of almost 2 miles. He jammed the control wheel as far over to the left as he could. Below them, the Civic Center began to wheel sickeningly around, as if it had been mounted on the spindle of a gigantic top. No, you bastard! Ed yelled, and something that felt like the head of a small hammer struck Ralph in the side, almost paralyzing him with pain and making it all but impossible to breathe. His hand slid off the control wheel as Ed hammered him again, this time in the armpit. Ed seized the wheel and yanked it savagely back over. The Civic Center, which had begun to slip toward the side of the windshield, began to rotate back toward dead center. Ralph clawed at the wheel. Ed placed the heel of his hand on Ralph's forehead and shoved him backward. Why couldn't you stay out of it? He snarled. Why did you have to meddle? His teeth were bared, his lips pulled back in a jealous snarl. Ralph's appearance in the cockpit should have incapacitated him with shock, but hadn't. Of course not, he's nuts, Ralph thought, and suddenly raised his interior voice in a panicked yell. Clotho! Lachesis, for Christ's sake, help me! Nothing. It didn't feel as if his shout were going anywhere. And why would it? He was back down on the short-time level, and that meant he was on his own. The Civic Center was only 800 or 900 feet below them now. Ralph could see every brick, every window, every person standing outside. He could almost even tell which ones were carrying signs. They were looking up, trying to figure out what this crazy plane was doing. Ralph couldn't see the fear on their faces, not yet. But in another 3 or 4 seconds, he launched himself at Ed again, ignoring the throb in his left side and driving his right fist forward, using his thumb to ride the prong of the earring out beyond his fingers as far as possible. The old earring gag had worked on the Crimson King, but Ralph had been higher then, and he'd had the element of surprise more firmly in hand. He went for the eye this time, too, but Ed snapped his head away at the last moment. The prong drove into the side of his face just above the cheekbone. Ed swatted at it as if it were a gnat, holding on tightly to the control wheel with his left hand as he did it. Ralph went for the wheel again. Ed lashed out at him. His fist connected above Ralph's left eye, driving him backward. A single loud tone, pure and silvery, filled Ralph's ears. It was as if there were a large tuning fork somewhere in between them, and someone had struck it. The world went as gray and grainy as a newsprint photograph.
"Ralph! Hurry!"
It was Lois, and now she was in terror. He knew why. Time had all but run out. He had maybe 10 seconds, 20 at most. He lunged forward again, this time not at Ed, but at the picture of Helen and Nat that was taped above the altimeter. He snatched it, held it up, and then crumpled it between his fingers. He didn't know exactly what reaction he'd hoped for, but the one he got exceeded his wildest hopes.
"Give them back!"
Ed screamed. He forgot about the control wheel and groped for the picture instead. As he did, Ralph again saw the man he had glimpsed on the day Ed had beaten Helen. A man who was desperately unhappy and afraid of the forces which had been set loose within him. There were tears not just in his eyes, but running down his cheeks. And Ralph thought confusedly, has he been crying all along?
"Give them back!"
he bawled again. But Ralph was no longer sure he was the subject of that cry. He thought his former neighbor might be addressing the being which had stepped into his life, looked around itself to make sure it would do, and then simply taken it over. Lois's earring glittered in Ed's cheek like a barbaric funerary ornament.
"Give them back! They're mine!"
Ralph held the crumpled photograph just beyond the reach of Ed's waving hands. Ed lunged. The seatbelt bit into his gut, and Ralph punched him in the throat as hard as he could, feeling an indescribable mixture of satisfaction and revulsion as the blow landed on the hard, gristly protuberance of Ed's Adam's apple. Ed fell back against the cockpit wall, eyes bulging with pain and dismay and bewilderment, hands going to his throat. A thick, gagging noise came from somewhere deep inside him. It sounded like some heavy piece of machinery in the process of stripping its gears. Ralph shoved himself forward over Ed's lap and saw the Civic Center now leaping up toward the airplane. He turned the wheel all the way to the left again, and below him, directly below him, the Civic Center again began to rotate toward the side of the Cherokee's soon-to-be-defunct windshield. But it moved with agonizing slowness. Ralph realized he could smell something in the cockpit, some faint aroma both sweet and familiar. Before he could think what it might be, he saw something that distracted him completely. It was the Hoodsy ice cream wagon that sometimes cruised along Harris Avenue, tinkling its cheery little bell. My God, Ralph thought, more in awe than in fear. I think I'm going to wind up in the deep freeze, along with the creamsicles and Hoodsy rockets. That sweet smell was stronger, and his hands suddenly seized his shoulders. Ralph realized it was Lois Chass's perfume.
"Come up!" she screamed. "Ralph, you dummy! You have to..."
He didn't think about it. He just did it. The thing in his mind clenched, the blink happened, and he heard the rest of what she had to say in that eerie, penetrating way that was more thought than speech.
"Come up! Push with your feet!"
Too late, he thought. But he did as she said, nevertheless, planting his feet against the base of the radically canted instrument panel and shoving as hard as he could. He felt Lois rising up through the column of existence with him as the Cherokee shot through the last 100 feet between it and the ground. And as they zoomed upward, He felt a sudden blast of lowest power wrap itself around him and yank him backward like a bungee cord. There was a brief, nauseating sensation of flying in two directions at the same time. Ralph caught a final glimpse of Ed Deepno slumped against the side wall of the cockpit. But in a very real sense, he did not see him at all. The thunderstruck yellow-gray aura was gone. Ed was also gone, buried in a death bag as black as midnight in hell. Then he and Lois were falling as well as flying. Just before the explosion came, Susan Day, standing in a hot white spotlight at the front of the Civic Center, and now living through the last few seconds of her fabulous, provocative life, was saying, "I haven't come to Derry to heal you, hector you, or to incite you, but to mourn with you. This is a situation which has passed far beyond political considerations. There's no right in violence, nor refuge in self-righteousness. I am here to ask that you put your positions and your rhetoric aside and help each other find a way to help each other. To turn away from the attractions of..." The high windows lining the south side of the auditorium suddenly lit up with a brilliant white glare and then blew inward. The Cherokee missed the Hoodsy wagon, but that didn't save it. The plane took one final half turn in the air and then screwed itself into the parking lot, about 25 feet from the fence where, earlier that day, Lois had paused to yank up her troublesome half-slip. The wings snapped off. The cockpit made a quick and violent journey back through the passenger section. The fuselage blew out with the fury of a bottle of champagne in a microwave oven. Glass flew. The tail bent over the Cherokee's body like the stinger of a dying scorpion, and impaled itself in the roof of a Dodge van with the words, "Protect Women's Right to Choose," stenciled on the side. There was a bright and bitter crunch clang that sounded like a dropped pile of scrap iron. "Holy shit," one of the cops posted on the edge of the parking lot began. And then the C4 inside the cardboard box flew free like a big gray glob of phlegm and struck the remains of the instrument panel, where several hot wires rammed into it like hypo needles. The plastique exploded with an ear-crunching thud, flash-frying the Bassey Park racetrack and turning the parking lot into a hurricane of white light and shrapnel. John Lydecker, who'd been standing under the Civic Center's cement canopy and talking to a state cop, was thrown through one of the open doors and all the way across the lobby. He struck the far wall and fell unconscious into the shattered glass from the harness racing trophy case. At that, he was luckier than the man with whom he'd been standing. The state cop was thrown into the post between two of the open doors and chopped in half. The ranks of cars actually shielded the Civic Center from the worst of the hammering concussive blow, but that blessing would only be counted later. Inside, over 2,000 people at first sat stunned, unsure of what they should do, and even more unsure of what most of them had just seen. America's most famous feminist decapitated by a jagged chunk of flying glass. Her head went flying into the sixth row like some strange white bowling ball with a blonde wig pasted on it. They didn't erupt into panic until the lights went out. 71 people were killed in the trampling, panicked rush to the exits. And the next day is Derry News would trumpet the event with a 48-point scare headline, calling it a terrible tragedy. Ralph Roberts could have told them that, all things considered, they had gotten off lucky. Very lucky indeed. Halfway up the north balcony, a woman named Sonia Danville, a woman with the bruises of the last beating any man would ever give her, still fading from her face, sat with her arms around the shoulders of her son, Patrick. Patrick's McDonald's poster, showing Ronald and Mayor McCheese and the Hamburglar dancing the boot scootin' boogie just outside a drive-through window, was on his lap, but he had hardly done more than color the golden arches before turning the poster over to the blank side. It wasn't that he had lost interest. It was just that he'd had an idea for a picture of his own, and it had come, as such ideas often did to him, with the force of a compulsion. He had spent most of the day thinking about what had happened in the cellar at High Ridge. The smoke, the heat, the frightened women, and the two angels that had come to save him. But his splendid idea banished these disturbing thoughts, and he fell to work with silent enthusiasm. Soon Patrick felt almost as if he were living in the world he was drawing with his Crayolas. He was an amazingly competent artist already, only 4 years old or not. My little genius, Sonia sometimes called him, and his picture was much better than the colored-in poster on the other side of the sheet. What he had managed before the lights went out was work a gifted first-year art student might have been proud of. In the middle of the poster sheet, a tower of dark, soot-colored stone rose into a blue sky dotted with fat white clouds. Surrounding it was a field of roses, so red they almost seemed to clamor aloud. Standing off to one side was a man dressed in faded blue jeans. A pair of gun belts crossed his flat middle. A holster hung below each hip. At the very top of the tower, a man in a red robe was looking down at the gunfighter with an expression of mingled hate and fear. His hands, which were curled over the parapet, also appeared to be red. Sonia had been mesmerized by the presence of Susan Day, who was sitting behind the lectern and listening to her introduction. But she had happened to glance down at her son's picture just before the introduction ended. She'd known for 2 years that Patrick was what the child psychologists called a prodigy, and she sometimes told herself she had gotten used to his sophisticated drawings and the Play-Doh sculptures he called the Clay family. Perhaps she even had, to some degree, but this particular picture gave her a strange deep chill that she could not entirely dismiss as emotional fallout from her long and stressful day. "Who's that?" she asked, tapping the tiny figure peering jealously down from the top of the dark tower.
"Him's the Red King," Patrick said.
"Oh, the Red King, I see.
And who's this man with the guns?"
As he opened his mouth to answer, Roberta Harper, the woman at the podium, lifted her left arm, there was a black mourning band on it, toward the woman sitting behind her. "My friends, Miss Susan Day," she cried, and Patrick Danville's answer to his mother's second question was lost in the rising storm of applause.
"Him's name is Roland, Mama. I dream about him sometimes. Him's a king, too."
Now the two of them sat in the dark with their ears ringing, and two thoughts ran through Sonia's mind like rats chasing each other on a treadmill. "Won't this day ever end? I knew I shouldn't have brought him. Won't this day ever end? I knew I shouldn't have brought him. Won't this day..."
"Mommy, you're scrunching my picture," Patrick said.
He sounded a little out of breath, and Sonia realized she must be scrunching him, too. She eased up a little. A tattered skein of screams, shouts, and babbled questions came from a dark pit below them, where the people rich enough to pony up $15 donations had been seated in folding chairs. A rough howl of pain cut through this babble, making Sonia jump in her seat. The thudding crump which had followed the initial explosion had pressed in painfully on their ears and shaken the building. The blasts, which were still going on, cars exploding like firecrackers in the parking lot, sounded small and inconsequential in comparison. But Sonia felt Patrick flinch against her with each one.
"Stay calm, Pat," she told him. "Something bad's happened, but I think it happened outside."
Because her eyes had been drawn to the bright glare in the windows, Sonia had mercifully missed seeing her heroine's head leaving her shoulders. But she knew that somehow lightning had struck in the same place.
"Shouldn't have brought him. Shouldn't have brought him."
And that at least some of the people below them were panicking. If she panicked, she and young Rembrandt were going to be in serious trouble. "But I'm not going to. I didn't get out of that death box this morning just to panic now. I'll be goddamned if I will." She reached down and took one of Patrick's hands, the one that wasn't clutching his picture. It was very cold.
"Do you think the angels will come to save us again, Mama?"
he asked in a voice that quivered slightly.
"Nah," she said. "I think this time we'd better do it ourselves. But we can do that. I mean, we're all right now, aren't we?"
"Yes," he said, but then slumped against her. She had a terrible moment when she was sure he had fainted and she'd have to carry him from the Civic Center in her arms. But then he straightened up again.
"My book was on the floor," he said. I didn't want to leave without my books, especially the one about the boy who can't take off his hat. Are we leaving, Mama?"
"Yes, as soon as people stop running around. There'll be lights in the halls, ones that run on batteries, even though the ones in here are out. When I say we're going to get up and walk up the steps to the door. I'm not going to carry you, but I'm going to walk right behind you with both my hands on your shoulders. Do you understand, Pat?"
"Yes, Mama."
No questions, no blubbering, just his books thrust into her hands for safekeeping. He held on to the picture himself. She gave him a quick hug and kissed his cheek. They waited in their seats 5 minutes by her slow count to 300. She sensed that most of their immediate neighbors were gone before she got to 150, but she made herself wait. She could now see a little, enough for her to believe that something was burning fiercely outside, but on the far side of the building. That was very lucky. She could hear the warble wail of approaching police cars, ambulances, and fire trucks. Sonia got to her feet. "Come on, keep right in front of me." Pat Danville stepped into the aisle with his mother's hands pressed firmly down on his shoulders. He led her up the stairs toward the dim yellow lights which marked the north balcony corridor, stopping only once as the dark shape of a running man hurtled toward them. His mother's hands tightened on his shoulders as she yanked him aside.
"Goddamn right to lifers!" the running man cried. "Fucking self-righteous turds! I'd like to kill them all!"
Then he was gone, and Pat began walking up the stairs again. She felt a calmness in him now, a scented lack of fear that touched her heart with love, and with some queer darkness as well. He was so different, her son, so special. But the world did not love people like that. The world tried to root them out like tares from a garden. They emerged at last into the corridor. A few deeply shocked people wandered back and forth, eyes dazed and mouths agape, like zombies in a horror movie. Sonia hardly glanced at them, just got Pat moving toward the stairs. 3 minutes later, they exited into the fire-shot night, perfectly unscathed. And upon all the levels of the universe, matters both random and purposeful resumed their ordained courses. Worlds which had trembled for a moment in their orbits now steadied. And in one of those worlds, in a desert that was the apotheosis of all deserts, a man named Roland turned over in his bedroll and slept easily once again beneath the alien constellations. Across town in Strawford Park, the door of the Porto San marked Men blew open. Lois Chass and Ralph Roberts came flying out backward in a haze of smoke, clutching each other. From within came the sound of the Cherokee hitting and then the plastique exploding. There was a flash of white light, and the toilet's blue walls bulged outward, as if some giant had hammered them with his fists. A second later, they heard the explosion all over again. This time it came rolling across the open air. The second version was fainter, but somehow more real. Lois's feet stuttered and she thumped to the grass of the lower hillside with a cry, which was partly relief. Ralph landed beside her, then pushed himself up to a sitting position. He stared unbelievingly at the Civic Center, where a fist of fire was now clenched on the horizon. A purple lump, the size of a doorknob, was rising on his forehead, where Ed had hit him. His left side still throbbed, but he thought maybe the ribs in there were only sprung, not broken.
"Lois, are you all right?"
She looked at him uncomprehendingly for a moment, then began to feel at her face and neck and shoulders. There was something so perfectly, sweetly our Lois about this examination that Ralph laughed. He couldn't help it. Lois smiled tentatively back at him.
I think I'm fine. In fact, I'm quite sure I am.
What were you doing there? You could have been killed.
Lois, appearing somewhat rejuvenated, Ralph guessed that the handy wino had had something to do with that, looked him in the eye.
I may be old-fashioned, Ralph, but if you think I'm going to spend the next 20 years or so fainting and fluttering like the heroine's best friend in those Regency romances my friend Minna's always reading, you better pick another woman to chum around with.
He gaped for a moment, then pulled her to her feet and hugged her. Lois hugged back. She was incredibly warm, incredibly there.